I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. On today's show, Mohsin Hamid on his latest novel, The Last White Man. Mohsin Hamid writes regularly for The New York Times, The Guardian, and The New York Review of Books, and is the author of Exit West, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, Moth Smoke, How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia, and Discontent and Its Civilizations. Born and mostly raised in Lahore, he has since lived between Lahore, London, and New York. And today we're going to be talking about Mohsin's latest novel, which is The Last White Man. Mohsin, welcome back to Little Atoms.
Thank you.
How would you describe this novel then?
So The Last White Man is the story of a young man named Anders who wakes up one morning and finds that his skin is dark. And when he'd gone to bed the night before, it wasn't. And he starts navigating a world where this begins to happen to more and more people with his girlfriend, Una. Una's mother and Anders's father, sort of at the center of what's happening in this small town as people change.
And so how does this transformation begin to affect Anders personally, how he sees himself and how he carries himself?
Well, Anders begins by sort of not believing this is actually happening. And so he wants to make sure that he's not imagining things. He's not having some kind of a strange perceptual episode. He first is hoping that it isn't happening. And then when it becomes clear to him that this is happening, he hopes it'll go away or reverse itself, but that doesn't happen either. And eventually he goes, he has his girlfriend Una come and have a look, and hoping that she'll say, well, it's not, you know, not much. But she doesn't say that at all. She says that, in fact, you look completely different. And Anders spends a lot of time trying to convey to the world that he's still the same person, that he hasn't changed. But he discovers in trying to do that, that it's impossible to do, that just by trying to be himself, he isn't being himself. He's more self-conscious. He's less at ease. And yeah, so his journey, his individual journey before it becomes widespread, is really one of increasing surprise at how what appears to be just a skin deep change is affecting him much more deeply than that.
So tell us something about Una, who is his friend and then sort of on off girlfriend, and then as the book progresses, his girlfriend. Tell us something about who she is.
So Una is a young woman who knew Anders in high school. They had, you know, a bit of a relationship in high school. She left their small town for the big city. She and Anders are similar in that they both lost a parent young, Anders' mother and Una's father. But more recently, Una has lost her twin brother as well. And she's back in town helping her mother really cope with this loss. And she finds herself in a relationship with Anders really just to sort of pass the time and something to do, you know, while she's back in town in this difficult situation. Doesn't think much of it. And in fact, when Anders changes, she initially sort of thinks that, you know, this is more than she signed on for. She didn't want some sort of heavy, emotionally invested, tumultuous sort of relationship. And yet she's surprised because Anders, even though he has changed, she finds herself seeing him more clearly, and the relationship begins to deepen, notwithstanding her earlier impulse to let it go.
I was going to raise the idea that they both have this thing in common, which is both of their families are touched by loss. Both at this time the book starts have a remaining parent. Obviously, Una has also recently lost her brother as well. But tell us something about Anders' father and Una's mother in the story, then.
So, as you say, the novel very much is a novel of loss. It's about loss, and not just the loss of whiteness, which Anders and others experience, but of losses in life. And so both Anders and Una have experienced this loss. Una's mother has experienced the loss of her husband when she was younger, and more recently her son, and has gone from somebody who imagined that the world was, generally speaking, a sort of benign and fairly righteous place to thinking that, you know, good things don't happen to good people. And in fact, things are taken from you and stolen from you. And she's begun to identify in a way with something bigger than herself, something to hold on to, something which she thinks is under threat. And that something is a kind of ethnic sense of whiteness, of white people becoming a minority, becoming erased, becoming less important, less significant, under threat. And so Una is desperate to prevent her mother from, you know, spending so much time online and on TV and listening to chat radio, where she's, in a sense, being sort of radicalized by the, you know, by online voices. But Una's mother finds herself born more deeply into this conspiracy theory, and in part because it turns out that there's some truth to it, that in fact, in the novel, white people are, in a sense, being erased. And so her paranoid fantasies find a reality to latch onto. Anders' father, on the other hand, like Una, Una's mother has experienced the loss of his wife. And he's perhaps always been a little bit disappointed in his son, in Anders, because Anders, things never came easy to Anders. Anders had a tough time learning to read, to write, to tie his shoelaces, to do all sorts of stuff. And Anders' father, who is a, you know, construction foreman, is a very get things done sort of matter of fact kind of guy, and he hopes that his son will be able to have that kind of sturdy attitude towards life, but he finds his son lacking in that, and when his son changes, Anders's father, in a sense, feels it's a real blow, because he recognizes that things will be much harder for his son now, and things have always been hard for his son. And Anders, of course, feels that, in a sense, his disappointment of his father is even more pronounced now that he has changed. But despite that, as is the case with Una and her mother, which is a caring relationship with a lot of tension in it, Anders and his father have a relationship of considerable care as well. Anders' father is profoundly unwell, and in fact, he's dying during the course of the novel. And he's doing his best to care for Anders, who's increasingly at risk as people react to this idea of people getting dark as malicious form, and people become more aggressive towards Anders. But also Anders is trying to care for his father as his father passes through the final days of his life. And so both of the parental-child relationships in the novel, in a way, are two other love stories, intergenerational love stories that balance out, I suppose, or coexist with the love story between Anders and Una.
Can we talk about the setting for a moment? So the characters live in a small town, which is unidentified, and indeed the country is unidentified, although there are enough clues to presume it's America. And in my head, I'd located it in a small town outside of a city like New York. But tell us something about the location it's set and I guess why you've anonymized it.
Well, it's interesting that you say that it feels like America to you, because I've heard different things from different readers. Some American readers have said that they think it's America, and some have said that, no, this is clearly not America. This is sort of, you know, some Nordic country or perhaps South Africa. And some people in Britain have said that, you know, it feels like the UK, but there's some Americanisms that make me think maybe it isn't. The idea that the place is not entirely specified and that the reader needs to come up with a sense of what this place is has to do with, I think, you know, how novels work and what makes them special. I think that of the mass reproduced storytelling forms at the moment, we have television and cinema, which present us with worlds that look very much like the world that we inhabit. But in a book, we are looking at something that looks nothing like that world. It's a series of words and spaces and punctuation marks. And we, the reader, we readers animate that into, in a sense, the film of the novel in our imaginations, into people and images and smells and feelings. And as we do that, we are creating the novel. I think that the novels that novelists write are really just half novels, and readers create the other half of the novel. And so I intentionally try to write novels that leave a lot of space for readers to create. And readers create a setting in the novel because it's not exactly clear where it's set. And they also fill in some other details. For example, you know, what exactly do people look like when they change? You know, what exactly is the racial order that is being created or undermined? And so the readers have to, in a way, make this, because the novel doesn't necessitate a particular reading. And I wanted that to be the case. I wanted readers to be free to imagine it into a space that they wanted the novel to exist, where they wanted it to, where they wanted to make it, really. So for me, it can be read as different places. And each reader has the freedom, in a sense. They're the location scout of the film in their mind, where they can position this where they want it to be.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Mohsin Hamid. We're talking about his latest novel, The Last White Man. And Mohsin, I thought of the US, I guess, trivially because everyone's got guns, but more so because obviously the thing that the book reminded me of is, and you clearly hint at with Una's mum becoming obsessed and being online, is the conspiracy theory of the Great Replacement, which is obviously worldwide because it's on the internet, but seems to be a thing that's particularly resonant in Trump's America. It's become sort of much more forefront and part of, you know, things leading up to like the January the 6th insurrection. And so I wanted to talk about that idea, where that idea comes from.
Well, I think, you know, this idea of the Great Replacement is something that I suppose has been part of human history forever. We're just seeing, you know, new permutations of it. At the most basic level, you know, every generation faces a kind of great replacement during the course of our lifetimes. As we get older, as our numbers dwindle, and as young people become more numerous, And in a sense, our way of life, each generation sees its way of life give way to a new way of life. And you know, throughout human history, there have been ways for societies to cope with this, to deal with this. One thing which I think has been happening more recently, specifically, as you say, in the United States, but also very much in Europe, I think that it may not be perhaps as widespread a view, but I think it's also fairly widespread. In the sense that in Europe, the notion of migrants coming in, of European populations being replaced by, you know, in quotes, non-European peoples, is certainly an animating factor in much of politics. In Britain, in a sense, you can regard the Brexit vote as partly a reaction to a kind of great replacement, although, of course, that great replacement wasn't necessarily of white people with non-white people, or not only that, but also of sort of native British-born people with immigrants from other parts of Europe. But the basic feeling of it, the idea that one's group is in danger of being supplanted, is something that has become very common all over the world, whether it's in Modi's India, where we see Hindutva and the idea of sort of reasserting Hindu greatness in the face of a kind of Muslim threat, whether it's in Pakistan, where, you know, Islam is perceived as under threat, whether it's in Erdogan's Turkey or Putin's Russia, where Turkishness or Russianness is under threat. In place after place, country after country, we see people kind of coming up with these nostalgic appeals to the better time in history, the time that has gone by. And so I think that Una's mother is reacting to that, which is, as you say, something that we see certainly in the US and elsewhere. But it's also part of just the general, I think, tenor of our culture in the early 21st century.
One of the things that struck me was, once lots of people start to change in the novel, there's militias that take over and there's violence and there's riots and society starts to break down for a little while. And we see there's this idea that people who have always been black can tell who the people are that have changed, and therefore those people feel threatened.
Well, it's unclear if that's actually the case. So in the book, there's certainly a fear. For example, Una's mother is afraid that this will happen, that there will be a way for people to tell who was, you know, one thing and who wasn't. Also, you know, Anders and Una are walking one evening, and they see a man who seems threatening to them, but then he sort of laughs and walks away, and it's as though what they were threatened by was the ghost of what they imagined this man to be. And it's not clear if he was always dark or if he'd become dark. And of course, Anders and Una are dark at this point. So I think what we're seeing to a certain extent in the novel are these echoes and ghosts and uncertainties. And I think that much of the relationship that we have to race is full of this stuff. It's, you know, oftentimes there are these things where you're not quite sure, you know, was that a racially charged encounter or not? Was that genuinely threatening or not? Was that meant to be intimidating or humiliating or not? I mean, of course, there are times when it's very clear, but there's also lots of times when it's not that clear. And so what happens in the novel is that even though, in a sense, everybody becomes dark, there are still echoes of people's, you know, fears and suppositions among those who, you know, who are in the middle of their lives. Although we do see, for example, in Anders and Una's child, who appears very much at the very end of the novel, many years hence, that her relationship to all this seems much less encumbered by these sorts of things. That as a person born native to this post-racial moment, she doesn't seem to be quite so hung up or engaged in, and in fact is sort of impatient with her grandmother's, and in fact slightly horrified by her grandmother's insistence on clinging to some kind of a racial identity. So yes, there is this stuff happening. It is echoing around. It doesn't necessarily go away at once, but it is possible that over time it becomes less and less. And as generations get used to a different way of seeing things, they find the need to think of these things less.
And of course, you never give any explanation in the story as to why this change is happening, which in a lot of ways just echoes the arbitrariness of, you know, racial categories anyway. But of course, as the change takes hold and the trouble starts and people are scared. We see people basically not leaving the house for long periods of time, which means also it's inescapable now to see echoes of the pandemic in this book.
Yeah, I think the book, in a sense, does have echoes of the pandemic. The book doesn't raise the idea that it's kind of some sort of pandemic-related phenomenon which is causing this effect of people becoming dark. It's left completely unexplained. But the emotional dynamics around it are in a sense related to the pandemic, which was unfolding as I was writing. The idea that there's something which could suddenly change life, that suddenly going to work or going to school or traveling might become impossible. That first one person is heard of as having changed, and then more, and it comes closer. And for a while, it's not quite clear how bad this is going to be. Will this descend into like full scale violence? Will there be no society left when it's over? It's maybe a little bit hard to remember now, but in those early months of the pandemic, we weren't quite sure just how bad this was going to get, and just how dangerous it was going to be, and just how profoundly human society would be transformed. As it turned out, the pandemic, while it had a horrific impact on millions of people who died and many more who lost loved ones and who got very, very ill, it didn't have perhaps that worst case scenario of a kind of plague-like death toll. But the fear that it might was there in the early part of it. And so in a sense, in the novel, that fear of what it will be, what will happen from this? How bad could it be? What will be left of society? Is present. And of course, what happens in the novel is that, something else is born and something else comes into being and the experience passes. But yes, it is a novel born of that pandemic time.
What other of your personal experiences have influenced the idea behind this novel?
Well, so many things. One of them would be how around the age of 30 in 2001, I went from being, a brown-skinned Muslim man, but a Muslim with a Muslim name that could be identified easily as being a Muslim. I went from, in a sense, having felt fairly low-level encounters with discrimination. I wouldn't have read discrimination as a particularly important part of my life in 2001. I mean, not to discount it completely, but it seemed that, if you lived in New York City, you had a well-paying job, you went to certain elite universities as I had, that you were able to sort of avoid the worst of discrimination. And then after 9/11, suddenly things changed. And, there was being stopped at the airport and being held at immigration for hours and forced to register when you entered the United States and people getting uncomfortable if you boarded a bus, unshaven on the weekend with a backpack. And sometimes they would switch seats and being hauled off an aircraft on the tarmac after you'd already boarded and sat in your seat, these sorts of things. And then for me, there's a profound sense of loss and a sense of, I want things to go back to how they were. And I started thinking, as the years passed as to what I had lost. And I thought, to a certain extent, there were certain privileges of a kind of partial whiteness that I had enjoyed. If whiteness is the idea that one can simply be, just be a human being without the attachment of suspicion or threat associated with being a Muslim or being dark-skinned, that was, in a sense, lost. The partial benefits of that were lost. And I think I dealt with that in a way, in a specific, Western Muslim mutual suspicion context in Doctrine Fundamentalist, which I wrote about 15 years ago. But the overall idea that race is this imaginary thing, and that it can be imagined into very different shapes, almost overnight, stayed with me. And I think very much fed into, Anders waking up one day, finding that his racial category has changed.
And in terms of other books that might have been an influence, I mean, Kafka's Metamorphosis is the obvious parallel, but what other books maybe?
Well, I've always been an admirer of sort of mid, 20th century modernist literature. Early mid, so the Virginia Woolf's and Kafka's and Camus, but also Jorge Luis Borges. And Borges, I think, is very interesting as a writer because he's so engaged with both playful tweaks of reality and formal experiments, and also, in a sense, the idea of how we see ourselves and how we are mirrors and how those mirrors constantly reflect each other. And I think that idea of kind of people being both mirrors and imagining onto other people's mirrors what they think they see, I think is that sort of Borgesian idea. Certainly, I would think of as kind of shaped me as a younger writer, and that probably shaped the outlook with which I approach this book.
To finish us off, can I get you to read us a bit?
Sure. So this is the very beginning of the novel, how the story starts. One morning, Anders, a white man, woke up to find he had turned a deep and undeniable brown. This dawned upon him gradually, and then suddenly. First as a sense as he reached for his phone that the early light was doing something strange to the color of his forearm. Subsequently, and with a start, as a momentary conviction that there was somebody else in bed with him. Male. Darker. But this, terrifying though it was surely impossible. And he was reassured that the other moved as he moved. Was in fact not a person, not a separate person, but was just him, Anders, causing a wave of relief. For if the idea that someone else was there was only imagined, then of course the notion that he had changed color was a trick too, an optical illusion or a mental artifact, born in the slippery halfway place between dreams and wakefulness, except that by now he had his phone in his hands and he had reversed the camera, and he saw that the face looking back at him was not his at all.
So I've been talking to Mohsin Hamid. We've been talking about his new novel, The Last White Man, which is out in the UK from Hamish Hamilton. Mohsin, thank you so much for taking the time to share it with me.
Thank you.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced, presented, and edited by me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is hosted by Acast and published by 89 Up. The show is broadcast on Mondays and Saturdays on Resonance 104.4 FM. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.